Now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, WHDH Radio News and Public Affairs present the Harvard Law School Forum, another in the series of informed discussions of current affairs. Tonight, recorded highlights of the topic, The Future of Integration. The guest speaker is the Reverend Martin Luther King, pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church of Atlanta, Georgia, Dr. King.
Professor Freund, members of the faculty and members of the student body of the Harvard Law School, ladies and gentlemen, I need not pause to say how very delighted I am to be here tonight and to be a part of this forum series. I have certainly looked forward to being here with eager anticipation. For as has been said, I had the opportunity of being a special student here at Harvard when I was a student at Boston University. And I will long remember the time and the hours I spent on the campus of this great institution of learning. And it is a real pleasure and privilege to come back and to have the opportunity of occupying this significant platform. I always consider it one of the very rewarding experiences of my life to take a brief break from the day-to-day demands of our struggle in the South and discuss the issues involved in the struggle with college and university students. And so this is a real pleasure and privilege, and I'm certainly happy to be here. I want to use as a subject this evening the future of integration. And in order to deal with the future of integration, it is necessary to assess the progress that has been made in the area of civil rights and the struggle for integration over the last few years. There are three basic attitudes that one can take toward the whole question of progress in race relations. The first position that can be taken is that of extreme optimism. The extreme optimist would point proudly to the strides that have been made in civil rights over the last few decades. From this, he would conclude that the problem is just about solved now, and that we can sit down comfortably on the wayside and wait for the coming of the inevitable. The second attitude that can be taken is that of extreme pessimism. The extreme pessimist would argue that we have made only minor strides in race relations. He would contend that the deep rumblings of discontent from the South, the presence of federal troops in Oxford, Mississippi, the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan, and the birth of white citizens' councils are all indicative of the fact that we are going backwards instead of forward, that we are retrogressing rather than progressing, and that in a real sense we are creating many more problems than we are solving. And from this, the extreme optimist, or rather the extreme pessimist, would conclude that there can be no real progress in race relations. Now, it is interesting to notice that the extreme optimist and the extreme pessimist agree on at least one point. They both feel that we must sit down and do nothing in the area of race relations. The extreme optimist says do nothing because integration is inevitable. The extreme pessimist says do nothing because integration is impossible. But that is a third position that can be taken, namely the realistic position. The realist in this area seeks to combine the truths of two opposites while avoiding the extremes of both. And so the realist would agree with the optimist that we have made strides, that we've come a long, long way. But he would balance that by agreeing with the pessimist that we have a long, long way to go before the problem of racial injustice is solved in our nation. And it is this realistic position that I would like to use as a basis for our thinking together tonight. We've come a long, long way, but we have a long, long way to go. And as we think of the future of integration, we must think of both sides. Now let us state first that we've come a long, long way. Now I'd like to point out that the Negro himself has come a long, long way in re-evaluating his own intrinsic worth. In order to verify this, a little history is necessary. You will remember that it was in the year 1619 when the first Negro slaves landed on the shores of this nation. They were brought here from the soils of Africa. Unlike the Pilgrim Fathers who landed at Plymouth a year later, they were brought here against their wills. And throughout slavery, the Negro was treated in a very inhuman fashion. He was a thing to be used, not a person to be respected. He was merely a depersonalized cog in a vast plantation machine. The famous Dred Scott decision of 1857 well illustrated the status of the Negro during slavery. But in this decision, the Supreme Court of the nation said in substance that the Negro is not a citizen of the United States. He is merely property, subject to the dictates of his owner. And it went on to say that the Negro has no rights that the white man is bound to respect. Living with the conditions of slavery and then later segregation, many Negroes came to see that they were caught in a system that would continually oppress them. And as this system grew, it had certain moral and religious justification. Not that it had moral justification in reality, but there were those who sought to give it moral justification. As slavery grew, it became necessary to give some justification for it. It seems to be a fact of life that human beings cannot continue to do wrong without eventually reaching out for some thin rationalization to clothe an obvious wrong in the beautiful garments of righteousness. The philosopher-psychologist William James used to talk a great deal about the stream of consciousness. And he says that one of the very interesting things about human nature is that man has a capacity temporarily to block the stream of consciousness and place anything in it that he wants to. And so we often end up justifying the rightness of the wrong. And this is exactly what happened during the days of slavery. This is a danger that forever confronts religion and a too literalistic interpretation of the Bible and religion were used to crystallize the status quo. And so it was argued from pulpits over the nation that the Negro was inferior by nature because of Noah's curse upon the children of Ham. And then the Apostle Paul's dictum became a watchword, servants, be obedient to your master. And then one brother had probably read the logic of Aristotle. You know, Aristotle did a great deal to bring into being what we know as formal logic. He talked about the syllogism, which had a major premise, a minor premise, and a conclusion. And so this brother could put his argument concerning the inferiority of the Negro in the framework of an Aristotelian syllogism. He could say all men are made in the image of God. This was the major premise. Then came the minor premise. God, as everybody knows, is not a Negro. Therefore, the Negro is not a man. And this was the type of reasoning that prevailed. Living with these conditions, many Negroes lost faith in themselves. And many came to feel that perhaps they were less than human. But then something happened to the Negro. Circumstances made it possible and necessary for him to travel more. The coming of the automobile, the upheavals of two world wars, the Great Depression. And so his rural plantation background gradually gave way to urban industrial life. His economic life was gradually rising through the growth of industry, and the growth of organized labor, expanded educational opportunities and other forces. And even his cultural life was gradually rising through the steady decline of crippling illiteracy. All of these forces conjoined to cause the Negro to take a new look at himself. Negro masses all over began to re-evaluate themselves. The Negro came to feel that he was somebody. His religion revealed to him that God loves all of his children, and that all men are made in his image, and that the basic thing about a man is not his specificity, but his fundamentum. Not the texture of his hat or the color of his skin, but his eternal dignity and worth. And so the Negro could now unconsciously cry out with the eloquent poet, fleecy locks and black complexion cannot forfeit nature's claim. Skin may differ, but affection dwells in black and white the same. Were I so tall as to reach the pole, or to grasp the ocean at a span, I must be measured by my soul. And the mind is the standard of the man. And with this new sense of dignity and this new sense of self-respect, a new Negro came into being with a new determination to struggle, and to suffer, and to sacrifice in order to be free. And so we've come a long, long way since 1619. But not only that, the whole nation has come a long, long way in extending the frontiers of civil rights. And if we are true to the facts, we must admit that. 50 years ago, or even 30 years ago, a year hardly passed when numerous Negroes were not brutally lynched by some vicious mob. But lynchings have about ceased today. 30 years ago, most of the states in the South used the poll tax as one of its cleverly contrived schemes to keep Negroes from becoming registered voters. But the poll tax has been eliminated in all but four states, and just a few months ago, the Congress of our nation unanimously brought into being legislation to bring about an amendment to the Constitution, bringing an end to the poll tax in federal elections. This means that we've made strides. In the area of voter registration itself, there has been some growth. At the turn of the century, there were very few Negroes registered to vote in the South. By 1948, that number had leaped to about 750,000. And today it stands at a little more than 1,500,000, far from what it ought to be. But it reveals growth. In the area of economic justice, we've made some strides. The average Negro wage earner of today makes 12 times more than the average Negro wage earner of 10 years ago. And the national income of the Negro is now $27 billion a year, which is more than all of the exports of the United States and the national budget of Canada. This reveals that some strides have been made. But probably more than anything else, we have seen in our generation the walls of legal segregation gradually crumble. We all know the long legal history of this system. It had its beginning in 1896, when the Supreme Court of the nation rendered a decision known as the Plessy versus Ferguson decision. And if we are honest, we know what happened as a result of the Plessy doctrine. And there was always a strict enforcement of the separate, without the slightest intention to abide by the equal. And so as a result of the Plessy Doctrine, the Negro ended up being plunged into the abyss of exploitation, where he experienced the bleakness of nagging injustice. But then on May 17, 1954, the Supreme Court examined the legal body of segregation and pronounced it constitutionally dead. It said in substance that the old Plessy Doctrine must go, that separate facilities are inherently unequal, and that to segregate a child on the basis of his race is to deny that child equal protection of the law. And as a result of this decision, we have seen some changes. We've seen segregation break down in many areas. As a result of the sit-in movement, for instance, more than 150 cities in the South have integrated their lunch counters. As a result of the Freedom Rides, segregation in intra and interstate travel is almost dead all over the South. When this decision was rendered in 1954, 17 states and the District of Columbia practiced absolute segregation in the public schools. But today, 14 of these states in the District of Columbia have made some move toward integrating their schools. Most of them have only been token moves, but they've made some move. And there are only three states that are standing out today in terms of massive resistance: the state of South Carolina, the state of Alabama, and the great sovereign state of Mississippi. These are the states that are holding out. And so this reveals that we've made some strides, to put it figuratively in biblical language. We've broken loose from the Egypt of slavery. And we have moved through the wilderness of segregation, and now we stand on the border of the promised land of integration. And there can be no gainsaying of the fact that the system of segregation is on its deathbed, and the only thing uncertain about it is how costly the South will make the funeral. We've come a long, long way since 1896. Now, this would be a wonderful place for me to end my lecture. Number one, it would mean making a short speech, and this would be a magnificent accomplishment for a Baptist preacher. But second, it would mean that the problem is solved, about solved in America, and we don't have anything to do. It would be a wonderful thing if every speaker could stop at this point and talk about this problem in terms of a problem that once existed, but no longer faces us. This would be wonderful. But if I stop here, I will merely be stating a fact, and not telling the truth. You know, a fact is merely the absence of contradiction, but truth is the presence of coherence. Truth is the relatedness of facts. Now, it's a fact that we've come a long, long way, but it isn't the whole truth. In order to get the whole truth, it is necessary to add the other side. And I'm afraid if I stop here, I will leave you the victims of a dangerous optimism. If I stop at this point, I may leave you the victims of an illusion wrapped in superficiality. So in order to tell the truth, it is necessary to move on and say not only have we come a long, long way, but we have a long, long way to go before this problem is solved in our nation. We do not have to look very far to see this. We know that interposition and nullification are still current words in some states. And the legislative halls of these states ring loud with these particular words. And this reveals that even in the legal area, we have a long, long way to go to convince certain people. I mentioned the fact that lynchings have about ceased today. But other things are happening just as bad. We turn to certain sections of our country, and we find that there are some individuals, maybe on the lunatic fringe, who will use any method to stand in the way of and block the law of the land. Even physical violence is often used. And so we see homes being bombed, we see churches being burned, all of these things being done to preserve the system of racial segregation. I mentioned the strides that have been made in voter registration, but we must see the other side. There are still more than 10 million Negroes in the United States living in the southern part of this nation. Almost 600 of the Negroes in the South are of voting age. And yet there are only about 1,500,000 registered to vote. And this means that there are millions of Negroes who are eligible to vote who are of voting age who are not registered. Now, it is true that some of these people are not registered because of internal apathy. This is true of people all over the country. But then many of these people are not registered because of external resistance. Many of them are not registered because all types of conniving methods are still being used to keep Negroes from becoming registered voters. Complex literacy tests are still being given. And often as Negroes go to seek to register, questions I ask that a PhD in any field or a person with a law degree from the greatest law schools of the nation or the world couldn't answer, to the even more difficult question, how many bubbles do you find in a bar of soap? And I understand the other day they asked a man, Negro man who went to register in Mississippi, how many windows are in the courthouse? Well, of course, I don't know how many windows are in my own house. I know I would know how many in the courthouse. But while this is a bit humorous, it is still true that many of these inhuman, ridiculous things are still being done to keep Negroes from becoming registered voters. Just a few weeks ago, I will never forget the tears that came to my eyes when I stood over the smoldering ruins of a church down in Lee County, Georgia, that had been burned down because Negroes in that county had been holding clinics on citizenship training and clinics on registration, voting and registration. And the individuals who burned this church burned it because they were trying to block the aspirations and the longings of the Negro people of that particular county to become registered voters. And so this reveals that we have a great deal to do in this particular area. I mentioned economic justice. And I guess the figure $27 billion looks like a big figure, and it is. But then before we console ourselves with that, we must see the other side. And that is that approximately 42% of the Negro families of the United States still earn less than $2,000 a year, while just 17% of the white families earn less than $2,000 a year. Approximately 20% of the Negro families of the United States earn less than $1,000 a year, while just 6% of the white families earn less than $1,000 a year. 88% of the Negro families of America still earn less than $5,000 a year, while just 58% of the white families earn less than $5,000 a year. The Negro is still the last hired and the first fired. There are industries all over this country with billions of dollars in government contracts. And yet in many of these industries, discrimination against Negroes and members of other minority groups is a notorious reality. And in these days of automation, the problem is more serious than ever before. For the Negro, by and large, in so many areas, has been confined to unskilled or semi-skilled labor. He has been denied apprenticeship training. And so now automation comes into being and takes away the very things that he could do. And so it compounds the problem even more. And you can well see what economic insecurity can do to an individual. For if one does not have economic security, he cannot educate his children. He cannot have adequate housing facilities. He cannot have adequate health facilities. And it is so easy to look on the surface and say, see these standards, these cultural standards that lag so far behind. But one must see that these conditions of economic inequality and other conditions are themselves the causal factors. It's so easy to say that the Negro is a criminal by nature, but one who is objective must come to see that these lagging standards and these other tendencies are here because of segregation. They are environmental and not racial. And poverty, ignorance, social isolation, and economic deprivation breed crime, whatever the racial group may be. And it is a torturous logic to use the tragic results of segregation as an argument for the continuation of it. There must be a strong, mobilized force getting back to the causal basis of the problem. And so there is a need for the nation to work passionately in this area of economic well-being in order to make economic justice a reality. And also, we have a long, long way to go before racial segregation is totally defeated. Now, I mentioned that we've made great strides in breaking down the barriers of segregation. And I implied, figuratively speaking, that old man segregation is on his deathbed. But history has proven that social systems have a great last-minute breathing power, and the guardians of the status quo are always on hand with their oxygen tents to keep the old order alive. And so segregation is still with us. We still confront it in its glaring and conspicuous forms in the South. We still confront it in its hidden and subtle forms all over the nation. But if democracy is to live, racial segregation must die. But I am convinced that segregation is a cancer in the body politic which must be removed before our moral and political health can be realized. And the fact is, we don't have long to do it. I know there are people who are saying, slow up for a while. There are people who are saying to the Negro in this struggle and his allies in the white community, stop pushing things too so fast, cool off. And they are saying adopt a policy of moderation. Well, if moderation means moving on toward the goal of justice with wise restraint and calm reasonableness, then moderation is a great virtue which all men of goodwill must seek to achieve during this tense period of transition. But if moderation means slowing up in the move for justice and capitulating to the undemocratic practices of the guardians of a deadening status quo, then moderation is a tragic vice which all men of goodwill must condemn. Now, only answer to that is that we can't afford to slow up. We have our self-respect to maintain, but even more than that, because of our love for America and the democratic way of life, we can't afford to slow up. And that out of approximately 3 billion people in this world, and as you know, the vast majority of these people live in Asia and Africa. And for years, most of them have been dominated.